Hello and welcome to Asia in Depth. I'm Dan Washburn. In early March, China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs announced that it would expel American journalists working for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post. The move was in apparent retaliation for an earlier decision by the American government to limit the number of Chinese journalists in the United States. It marked a significant milestone in the deteriorating relationship between the two countries. One of the journalists forced to leave China was The Post's Jerry Scher. Since joining the paper in 2018, Scher's reporting stood out for its focus on the lives of ordinary people in China. In recognition of his work, Scher was awarded Asia Society's 2020 Osborne Elliott Prize for Excellence in Journalism on Asia, joining a select group of some of the world's best writers and editors over the last two decades. In this episode, we're going to hear a conversation between Scher, who is now based in Seoul, and Marcus Brockley, former executive editor of The Post and the jury chair for this year's Oz Elliott Prize. Brockley begins the discussion by asking Scher how the expulsion of American reporters will affect our understanding of what's going on in China.
I think, you know, there will certainly be a huge loss for, I think, you know, readers, not just in the U.S., but across the world. In fact, I think, we often hear from the Chinese ordinary people, even Chinese officials, that they often turn to international news sources to get sort of a relatively unvarnished view of what's happening inside their own country. I think that let's take the example of one of the stories that I did last year. I went down to Jiangsu province in the wake of a large chemical explosion that killed scores of people. I was in a very kind of poor village that was just a couple of hundred meters away from the blast site. That was basically a crater that was, a quarter mile wide. The villagers at first, they very tentatively sort of began to talk to me, to tell me about the experience of sort of living for decades in the shadow of this, basically a ticking time bomb. In the middle of the conversation, one of the villagers suddenly said, hey, you know, so who did you say you work for again? And I said, well, you know, I work for the Beijing Bureau of the Washington Post. We're an American newspaper. Can't really dance around that. And then she said, well, how do we know that you are not here to smear us and make China look bad and write about all this negative news? And then somebody else in the group said, hey, listen, if this guy doesn't write the story, if we don't tell him our story, do you really think that the Jiangsu official newspaper or the local city newspaper, they're going to accurately tell our story? And then everybody else in the circle said, yeah. Like what he said is right. We should trust and talk to this guy. And so I think, you know, from the ordinary people to the Chinese scholars, academics, think tank types, government officials that I run into, on a daily basis, or I ran into on a daily basis, I should say, I think there is still a tremendous desire, despite all the tensions and the sort of the chill that we're living in today between the U.S. and China, there's a great, great desire to interface, to engage, to get the story out, to have that exchange of ideas. Long way of saying that I do really regret this, especially at this moment when there's a global crisis and public health emergency unfolding.
Yeah. Well, clearly the mutual understanding element of journalism is critical, because it creates some, you know, factual foundations for understanding, which probably leads to greater stability. But how much those people you see in China, do they have access to, will they ever see what you write? How much of what American journalists write gets recirculated in China? How much of it gets around the so-called Great Firewall?
That's a very interesting and I think a sort of an urgent question. As you might know, as many people might know, many, many of the international news outlets are now blocked inside China. So that includes everything from the New York Times and Bloomberg, beginning about a decade now ago, the Washington Post, the Guardian, the BBC, the list goes on, basically any major sort of American or British outlet that you can think of. China, of course, has a very tightly controlled and tightly censored media ecosystem that largely revolves around the social media platform WeChat. And I think that in order for the Chinese to access the internet, they need a certain degree of technical savvy. They need to be able to download a special software called virtual private networks to get around this censorship apparatus, which is commonly called the Great Firewall. Using this software can carry risks. It can lead to arrests, and police are increasingly enforcing these punishments against users. And I think the implications of that are pretty far-reaching. I think we are sort of increasingly living in a world where the populations of the two most powerful countries on Earth are consuming wildly, vastly different media diets. It's kind of almost an international parallel to what you might see in terms of the political polarization in the United States between the left and the right and sort of the news that they consume and how that shapes their thinking. And so, you know, if you were to look at international coverage of the protests in Hong Kong this past year, you would have seen something that was vastly different from how it was portrayed inside China. And as a result, I think, you know, you would have seen a tremendous amount of nationalism inside China, people sort of really rallying around the government to condemn the protests as violent rioters. You know, I worry a lot actually about the depths of this information divide. I think that, you know, today, especially, the Chinese government has grown increasingly sophisticated at how it conducts what it calls public opinion guidance. So for every major news event, you know, there are not only state media articles, but also a flurry of social media articles that also sort of gently nudge public opinion in a certain direction. That's now spread overseas. And, you know, as we've seen, one of the most popular social media accounts actually in the last couple of years has been what's this account on WeChat called College Daily for overseas Chinese students often studying in the US. This was started by a couple of college students who had interned at Western companies like Cisco and accountancy firms. But they, you know, put up a lot of content every day that toes the party line, including sort of, you know, a very, very, how shall I say, very, very, it basically disinformation during the height of the Hong Kong protests last year. And I think that certainly has an effect on the Chinese population, not only inside China, inside the Great Firewall, but also around the world.
So that observation triggers a couple of questions. The first is, you know, going back to how people in China are using VPNs to see foreign information. First question is, do you think that the Chinese government took the opportunity to expel these American journalists because of concerns that their information is flowing back into China? Or do you think it was more in response to the US government's decision to restrict the access, severely restrict the access of Chinese so-called state media organizations like CGTN and Xinhua in the US, which I think was the sort of official explanation, but which, based on what you've just said now, you can understand why people in foreign policy might be concerned at flows of information going back into China that are perhaps representing a Communist Party point of view as opposed to what might be described as a more factual point of view.
Certainly, I think it's a tricky question to answer. I think if we were to take the broader view over a larger time period, I think in the last decade, China has increasingly used visas as a way to sort of keep foreign journalists in line, to not sort of cross red lines into areas that they don't want. Coverage, for example, the private sort of business and financial interests of the top leaders. We have seen a growing number, I think, according to the Foreign Correspondents Club of China, more than a dozen journalists have been expelled in something like the last 7 years, or I should say effectively expelled by the Chinese government when they let their visas expire, effectively forcing them out. So, you know, we, of course, had one instance last year when the Chinese government expelled a Wall Street Journal reporter who was involved in a story about a relative of President Xi Jinping. Fast forward, we have, I can say that the immediate trigger of the expulsion of the dozen or so from the American newspapers stemmed from the U.S. Move to sharply limit the number of visas that Chinese state media outlets could have from about 160 down to 100. And so certainly there's an element of the tit and tat. It takes two to tango, let's put it that way. And since then, in the last couple of weeks, the U.S., the Trump administration has continued to hit back with quite onerous restrictions on Chinese journalists who want to seek visas. I think the overall trend in China domestically has been a gradual tightening of the media. They've taken a much more assertive and sort of a pugnacious attitude towards the foreign media. At the same time, I think they've encountered a counterparty in the Trump administration that seems more than willing to sort of trade blows on this issue that I think many journalists, including foreign correspondents and myself in China, would see as basically a race to the bottom, that this can't have a good outcome for anybody.
How onerous was it to cover China pre-COVID, and how did it change? I'd be interested just sort of in your career trajectory, when you first came to China, and how things have changed for journalists in that time.
Sure. I first arrived in 2014. I think that I, missed those golden years of the 80s, like, you know, we were just talking to Dinda about, of sort of that, you know, opening, that blossoming. I think that in the early 2000s, there was also a great amount of, openness in blogging. Of course, you know, in the 1990s, after Tiananmen, foreign journalists, whenever they couldn't even leave Beijing, right? So basically you had a shadow, kind of a tail with you physically all the time. In the 2010s, when I arrived, we never had that. I think surveillance through electronic means has been pervasive. Who might express their frustration with how things are going. But as the political climate in China, I think, becomes more tightly controlled, they're also, you know, much more cautious. And in terms of the mechanics of reporting in China, like I said, with the sort of the rise of WeChat, I hear stories of correspondents before my generation who would duck into restaurants to borrow a phone to call their source, and there's little things that you can do sort of in the cat and mouse game that every China correspondent sort of, you know, picks up. And today that's just so much more difficult. You know, I've had instances where because WeChat, which is a software program that's, you know, very closely monitored, because it's so ubiquitous and you have no other way of reaching somebody other than that software, sometimes you might call somebody who wants to talk to you, wants to give you information, and then an hour later they get a call from the local police. It's always tricky.
So this expulsion of journalists came basically amid this COVID crisis. And COVID, as some people in the US like to point out, originated in China. And there was a period of time when information about COVID was murky at best and suppressed clearly by the government. What has been the role of foreign journalists? What was the impact of foreign journalists in covering this particular crisis, especially at the beginning when the government was not being as forthcoming as it probably should have been with information about what was happening in Wuhan?
I think that the having an independent foreign media was tremendously important. There were, in fact, many citizens inside Wuhan who I've kept in touch with and I spoke to at that time in real time, who were enormously frustrated with the coverage that they were seeing in China's official state media, which was basically interview after interview with medical workers who were talking about sort of the kind of the success that they were having in battling the outbreak, and not really, I think, offering a picture of the true scale and the enormity of the human tragedy and of this problem. That said, even if that the world media had reported that, it's not clear, as we later saw, that governments around the world would have made adequate preparations and really took that to heart. But I think that absent that reporting, maybe our understanding of those early days would have been even more limited.
It looked at the beginning in January, as a reader of China coverage, that as people in China were discovering the severity of the Wuhan crisis, that the leadership was somewhat back-footed, that it was looking vulnerable. It was looking like it had screwed up, and that people were angry both with the slowness of the response and then angry with the overwhelming force of the reaction when they finally shut everything down. Do you think it had, subsequent to that, obviously we've seen other countries, including the United States, fumble in their own ways. And I wonder if that's been redemptive in some way for the Chinese leadership with their people, or whether COVID has actually in any way hurt the Chinese leadership standing with the people.
Yeah, my personal analysis, I've always kind of been skeptical that this would have been the Chernobyl moment that would have sort of poked holes inside the veneer of the Communist Party monolith and sort of brought everything crashing down. I think that we did see for a brief period an outpouring of rage and frustration, particularly around the death of the so-called whistleblower Dr. Li Wenliang. The night that he died, I remember staying up in a hotel in eastern China in this basically totally abandoned mega city of like 10 million people. The outpouring was of just unprecedented scale of sort of messages on social media. But of course, basically by dawn, by 6 a.m., it was completely scrubbed from the internet. You couldn't really tell that anything had happened. At the end of the day, nobody was able to go out into the streets to mobilize. And pretty soon after that, a couple of weeks after that, the Chinese government did indeed bring the domestic outbreak pretty much under control. President Xi went and visited Wuhan. And I think in the weeks since, the Chinese government lined that, we have indeed done a pretty good job at bringing this outbreak under control compared to countries in Europe, especially compared to the United States, which is by and far the biggest sort of casualty of the epidemic. I think that's resonated with the Chinese people, combined with this sort of wall-to-wall propaganda and spin about the good deeds that the government has done, combined with oh look at how the outside world is blaming us for their own failures. I think the siege mentality plus the genuine accomplishments of the Chinese government combined has been very, very, has been very effective in bringing the people to rally around the government. That said, I think, you know, we do often see cracks showing among the elite levels. We see more sort of dissent, whether it's direct or oblique, from intellectuals, from elite businessmen, more than ever. And I think that, you know, if we are to see some kind of significant political change or reform in China in the coming years, it's going to come from those voices, that the people inside the elite circles of government, inside business, inside academia, who say that enough is enough with the sort of the direction, the totalitarian direction that things are heading.
Hi, Dan here. I'd like to take a moment to talk about Asia Society's YouTube channel, which now boasts over 170,000 subscribers. You can find the latest Asia Society programs covering the current events, policy, and culture of Asia, as well as explore our extensive library of musical performances, panel discussions, podcast episodes, and more. To join us, go to youtube.com/Asia Society and hit subscribe. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
You could elaborate on the footage of the extreme lockdown measures taken by local authorities, e.g. welding people into their apartment buildings or placing electronic sensors on people. How severe was that kind of clampdown in China? Was there on the food supply chain? I guess this is a question about the U.S. thoughts on the Smithfield meatpacking plants, but that's Chinese owned. But I mean, just how severe was the clampdown in China during COVID?
In places like Wuhan, it was absolutely severe, and in other cities across the country as well. I was in Hangzhou during the sort of the early days of the outbreak, and I was talking to somebody there who was he had traveled back home from outside of his province, and the neighborhood committee basically escorted him back into he and his family back into his apartment, and then threw a chain around his door and then padlocked it. And so he's banging on it, and he's like, "Guys, you can't keep me in here. I mean, I'm you know, what if there's a fire, you know, and I can't get anybody's attention." And so, you know, I think that in many of these areas, people were, you know, deadly serious about enforcing the rules. In other areas, it kind of depends district by district. The neighborhood committees in China, often when you have these sort of mass mobilization campaigns, everybody's kind of winging it, to be honest. It kind of depends on how every unit, have every sort of local organization interprets the rules. In Beijing, it was quite intense. I have heard of stories of friends who had come to Beijing and they were put into hotels and given electronic key cards to their doors that could only be used once. which is a pretty clever way of, right? You can get out, but you can't, get back into your room. I think that, it is every neighborhood across the country kind of, padlocking residents inside their homes. I don't think so, but it's pretty tough stuff.
Yeah, my experience with China is there's always a certain, among the bureaucracy, a certain enthusiasm for enforcement. I used to joke that China has two modes, tolerate and repress. And they basically toggle between the two.
Yeah, exactly.
Someone else has asked about to take us in a completely new direction, but an interesting one. Talking about the frictions between the US and China, the current 5G competition and the situation around Huawei. I guess the question is, what's your view on it? But let me elaborate on the question without knowing what the questioner's intention is, but ask, the technological rivalry between the US and China, as well as the trade and economic rivalry, increasingly threatens to split the world into two camps, or this is a great concern. And as the US cuts off China from certain technologies, it forces China to build those technologies itself, which simply, you know, widens the gulf. Do you think that this is where things are going? Are we entering a world from the economic trade technology perspective of a US block and a China block?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's the direction that things are going. I think one piece of context I would add to that is that I think, you know, ever since I arrived in China in 2014, I remember writing about China's efforts to sort of become technologically sort of independent, not dependent on U.S. technology. And so at the time, they were sort of, you know, strongly already beginning measures to sort of push out American providers such as Cisco and Qualcomm and Microsoft through various measures to sort of develop its domestic industry, which they have every right, you know, from a national industrial policy perspective to do, to further their own sort of national interests. But I think that this process, in many ways, this confrontation that we're seeing in many ways might be almost inevitable if you look at the trends of where things have been, the direction at which, you know, things have been unfolding in the last couple of years. Not only do I see a sort of, you know, distinct spheres in terms of technology, but I worry that, as I said earlier, information will become sort of divided into these two kind of mutually exclusive spheres. I worry that culturally there might be greater distance. There is a growing sort of, you know, suspicion of Chinese students in America, Chinese scholars and researchers. And I think that, you know, in many cases, aside from the espionage threats, I think that there is, I worry that American society and Chinese society increasingly find it difficult to sort of have a conversation on many of these, you know, major issues of global importance. So aside from the internet, China basically had already walled itself off, sort of, you know, 10 years ago. So we were already moving in that direction. Now it seems like technology, I guess finance would be a big, question to see, you know, whether China would take some steps to sort of extricate itself from the dollar, system. And the American banking system, and of course, the biggest question of all is geopolitics. You know, we have in the last couple of years seen China gain a great deal of support and prestige internationally, particularly from the developing world, through its sort of lending programs, through its very assiduous diplomacy. We have also seen, I think it's fair to say, you know, a very sharp pullback in terms of U.S. standing internationally as a leader, and also its commitments to world organizations. And so I think that is going to be such a major battleground now. You know, is our country going to rally around China? Which direction is Europe going to go? Which direction is Russia going to go? The Gulf states, you know, sort of the chessboard is kind of laid out, and it's kind of it's sort of, yeah, playing out in pretty with mind-blowing speed.
So I see that trend. I also see a sort of counter trend, which is China is able to project a sort of unified face of China to the world, China is not unified at home. China, you know, Xi Jinping has failed pretty miserably to manage what you might call the peripheral populations, the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, the people of Hong Kong, and I wouldn't say Taiwan is even a peripheral population. It's a desired population. But he has these great internal frictions. And as your story on the Hui people showed, which would be interesting to talk about, the Hui are, you know, another Islam following minority in central China. It's not a cohesive China. He has trouble holding it together. And it seems that Xi is actually having more trouble holding it together than his predecessor did. Maybe that's unfair to him, but I'd be interested to know, you know, how does that affect his ability to govern China and to project power in the world?
I think that this is such a huge issue that I kind of have some trouble wrapping my arms around it myself. But I think that a lot of these sort of tensions and frictions that you're seeing today are kind of a vestige and a legacy of the Qing dynasty's breath, right? I mean, it basically stretched from the middle of modern Kyrgyzstan, you know, down to modern day Vietnam. And it's just, itself was a sort of a foreign kind of sort of ethnic, ruling caste. And so, today China is so diverse, it's so large, it has so many sort of different cultural backgrounds, and is trying to keep everything together. And Xi's kind of basic MO, or his basic strategy, has been to kind of do nation building through, a narrow vision of ethno-nationalism, what it means to be Chinese. Much of that is kind of centered around, of course, the Han majority identity. And so, you know, the education campaigns that he's introduced in Xinjiang, the basic concept of that is to build patriotism, is to enhance this awareness, this sense among these people who culturally and linguistically and in terms of their sort of their phenotype are very much different from Han Chinese, but he's trying to sort of inculcate forcibly the sense that, you know, they are Chinese, they're taught the same Chinese sort of, you know, children's books that Han Chinese elsewhere might be taught, and to sing the songs, to even get married wearing sort of ethnic Han costumes. And I think that it's the authoritarian, I guess, twist on what's actually been historically a kind of a very commonly seen tactic of nation building.
One of your stories was fascinating story from across the border in Tajikistan, I think it was.
Yeah.
And you came across a Chinese military encampment there. How did you come to that story, if you can talk about it? And what does it tell us about China's ambitions in its near abroad?
Sure. I actually that story kind of went had roots quite early. I think it was in 2016 when I started to. I was working at the Associated Press at the time. My editor Jillian Wong, who's now at the New York Times, we wanted to start looking into the issue of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, because she had great sources to her sort of nearly 10 years working in China. And we kind of had the idea to sort of travel to Turkey and also Central Asia. And I think that, you know, in the course of my reporting at that time, the angle actually initially that we were looking into was the phenomenon of Uyghur militants who are leaving China through Southeast Asia to go to Turkey, to then travel into Syria to join with sort of Al-Qaeda affiliated militias there. During the course of that reporting, we sort of, you know, met with a lot of these refugees. We have refugees in Turkey who told us about this massive, massive campaign of detention and re-education and basically disappearance that was unfolding inside their homeland. And then sort of, you know, I guess it was out of that, you know, train of reporting that got me aware of not only what was happening in Xinjiang, but also what China was doing to sort of counter this threat of potential Uyghur extremism, whether it was Chinese military activity in Syria or this very concrete example that I was able to eventually prove in Tajikistan. And so what we basically found was that there is a there is a chain. A source had told me that they had seen Chinese soldiers in this very, very remote town in the Pamir Mountains of Tajikistan, near the highest point in the former Soviet Union. And so I thought I would go check it out. And what I had found was indeed there was a Chinese military base there. And later, according to satellite imagery, we discovered that there was actually more than one. And so on, I think, one of my last days that I was there, just kind of poking around, I ran into one of these guys who had come into town. I had already talked to some of the locals who said, yeah, you know, for the last couple of years, there's been these Chinese guys. They're nice. They come into town. They buy water and potato chips and sort of, you know, they'll speak a couple words of Russian, but kind of leave us alone and then disappear. We have no idea what they're doing. And so I thought, okay, all right, maybe I could run into one of these guys. And on, you know, on my last day in this town, I was just kind of walking around going to buy some water myself. And boom, I run into one of these guys and sort of, you know, chat him up. And he says, oh, you know, he basically told me, you know, what I wanted to know. So it was a bit of, you know, it was a stroke of luck. But also I think, you know, it was rooted in reporting that had gone back several years. So I'm happy that, you know, something like that was able to come to fruition.
Yeah, very revealing. Two last questions from me. First is, when did you decide you wanted to write about China?
This opportunity came up. I was working at Reuters, you know, in 2014 when this opportunity came up. I actually didn't expect to go to China at the time. But I speak Chinese. I have the language advantage. I'm familiar with the culture. And so I think that, you know, when the opportunity came up, I seized it. I think it's, it's so central and more central every day to global events.
Do you think you'll be allowed to work as a journalist in China again?
I hope so. I sincerely hope so. And I think I will. When I left, the Chinese foreign ministry said, you know, you don't blame us, blame it on the United States. We had to kick you out. It's not personal, but we had to kick you out because they kicked out our state media reporters. Do I believe that 100%? Not 100%. But, you know, I suppose, should I take their word for it? That, you know, there might be a day when I'll be allowed to go back and report. Sure, I'll hold on to that thought.
That's it for this week's episode. You can subscribe to Asia in Depth on Apple, YouTube, and Spotify, and check out past episodes by visiting our show page at asiasociety.org/podcast. We want to extend our best wishes to all our listeners. Stay safe out there. We're all in this together. I'm Dan Washburn. See you next time.